dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. It happens that that war is not being played out exclusively overseas. Indeed, we've witnessed in recent days evidence of a particularly insidious manifestation of this war right here in the United States of America. We'll talk momentarily about a case in Michigan involving a phenomenon known as female genital mutilation, or FGM. This is something that is not unique to, unfortunately, the situation in Michigan, but is unfortunately a much bigger problem. And nobody understands this better, I would argue, than our guest at the moment, our first guest, Noni Darwish. Noni is, among other things, a former Muslim. In fact, she founded a group called Former Muslims United. She is also the founder of Arabs for Israel and a senior fellow at the Center for Security Policy. She's also an author several times over, best-selling books, including most recently Wholly Different: Why I Chose Biblical Values Over Islamic Values. Noni Darwish, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. Great to have you with us.
My pleasure, Frank. Thank you.
Well, as I say, I want to talk about this case in a moment. But first, Noni, set the stage for us. Talk a little bit about your own personal experience with this horrific practice of mutilating women's genitals or girls' genitals from your experience in your native Egypt.
Well, the majority of women and girls in Egypt have undergone female genital mutilation. My mother herself has experienced that, and she, until today, remembers it with a lot of pain and a lot of anger. And it is, a lot of people say that this is has nothing to do with Islam. It's just a cultural thing. FGM is a cultural thing. Don't judge Islam by this. But how come Islam did not come to fix it and prohibit it? If a religion is supposed to come and teach us through God what humanity should and should not do. But to adopt the social, cultural things and negative aspects of life and incorporate it within Islam and into Sharia, that's what Islam did, even though a lot of Muslims want to deny it. But it is part of the Sharia, and it's part of the Hanafi school of Sharia.
Talk about why, Noni, as you see it, this has been enshrined in and is being perpetrated to this day, including not just in places like Egypt overseas, but here in our own country.
Islam did not prohibit it, perhaps because it is something that kept women down. It pushed women down. It destroyed the relationship between men and women. It destroyed the self-esteem of a woman. And all of this is, in my opinion, part of the larger plan of pushing women down and fracturing the healthy relationship between a man and a woman, because men are supposed to stay dedicated to the jihad. This makes sense to me, because the last thing Islam cares about is women's happiness and women expressing their a healthy aspect of their sexuality. And
Well, and especially clinging to their men so that they don't go off and wage the jihad to further the expansion of Islam. I think this is a very profound insight. Noni, I did want to talk about this business of a cultural attachment or diversity that we have to be sensitive to. As you mentioned to me off air, Fuambai Amadou was interviewed by Tucker Carlson, a woman who had apparently voluntarily subjected herself to what she calls not female genital mutilation, but female circumcision on Tucker's show last night. And, you know, there does seem to be a concerted effort being made here to claim that that's really all there is just some sort of circumcision as with male children, and that it should be considered protected, actually, under freedom of religion. What is your response to that contention?
It was a very sad moment to watch that show because I watched it, and I saw this woman defending FGM, and she was quite eloquent, and that's the dangerous part, educated and eloquent, and she was just equating it, well, it's just like male circumcision, and defending it. So after they have tried to deny it has anything to do with Islam, now they're defending it. So the game is constant. It's a constant cat and mouse game. Now they are all trying to defend the doctors that who are involved in this matter right here in America, American-trained doctors who are performing female genital mutilation right here in America. And I am shocked, Frank, to see that no women are up in arms. Where are the American feminists? Even the media.
Well, it's not no women. God knows you are. And, of course, Ayaan Hirsi Ali has been doing it prominently as well, but not nearly as many as one would like. And, Noni, I do want to share with our listeners a very, very important statement about a similar kind of cultural norm that dates back to, I think it's in the 1840s, when a gentleman by the name of General Sir Charles James Napier opposed the practice when he was the commanding general in India, colonial India, of something called sati, which was burning widows alive on the funeral pyres of their husbands. And he replied to this by saying, "This burning of widows is your custom. Prepare the funeral pile. But my nation also has a custom. When men burn women alive, we hang them and confiscate all their property." And he went on to say that's what would be done to anybody who practiced this in India under his watch. This seems to me to be sort of the kind of approach that we ought to be taking here, mutilating little girls. And in the case in Michigan, and let's talk just for a moment about that, Noni, we only know of two of these girls so far, but two doctors and an administrator have been charged in this practice, and one of them at least has been engaged in it since for some 12 years. Tell us a little bit about how you think this ought to play out, Noni, this prosecution, the fact that it's even happening at all, for that matter.
Well, the cultural clashes just came to America, and it's we have to make a stand to our values right here in America. Here is the British man who stood inside India objecting to this practice. And he was very brave to do that from inside a culture in India. Can you believe it that we are inside America having to put up with this? This has to be very put to the high. This has to be we have to make an example of these two doctors, and if we don't, then this is going to be a practice that's going to be very hard to erase.
Let me just mention one other thing, Noni, in closing. We've got to leave you, I'm afraid, at this point. But I would say to women like this gal on Tucker Carlson's program who would have us believe that this is really basically the same thing as circumcision for males, This is much closer, if not in fact identical, to the practice of castration of a male than circumcision. And to try to obscure that is, frankly, an affront and an outrage. And I couldn't agree with you more, Noni, that this must be stopped in America. Thank you for the great work you do, Noni, with us at the Center for Security Policy and in so many other outlets. God bless you, my dear. Come back to us again very soon. Thank you for your time today. Next up, we will be speaking with Rowan Scarborough. That and more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We are joined by one of the great national security reporters of our time. He is Rowan Scarborough. He writes for these days for the Washington Times, where he is their national security reporter. He is also the author of two best-selling books, Rumsfeld's War, The Untold Story of America's Anti-Terrorist Commander, and Sabotage, America's Enemies Within the CIA. Rowan, it's so good to have you back. Welcome.
Good to talk to you, Frank.
You have been doing a series of articles that I think have been incredibly important, Rowan, in recent weeks about this so-called dossier about Donald Trump, in which it was alleged that he had conducted himself in a manner that lent itself to, blackmail or other coercion by the Russians. You have really picked this thing apart, and I wonder if you might quickly tell us the story and how on earth this thing continues to have any legs at all.
I'd be glad to, Frank. There's two things going on today. Democrats continue to cite this memo from an opposition researcher who happens to be a former British spy, Christopher Steele. On the other hand, as people look at this dossier closer and closer, it becomes more and more inaccurate. And so it shows to a certain degree how desperate Democrats are to nail Trump and to get some sort of a special prosecutor or special commission that they have to cite this discredited piece of paper. And my latest reporting was that I obtained a court filing from Mr. Steele himself in London, where he's being sued for libel over his dossier. And in it, he acknowledges that a major charge that he made was not verified, that he put it into the dossier and it was for others to verify, not for him. It kind of shows you, if you extrapolate that onto the rest of the dossier, it shows what it really was. It was just sort of unvetted intelligence.
It was a hit piece is what it was, to put a fine point on it. And as you say, Rowan, despite the fact that it seems to be, a fabrication, it is still being cited by Democrats. How do they get away with this?
Because the New York Times media does not call them on it. That's how. I mean, at the March 20th House Intel Committee hearing, four Democrats read from the dossier, read unsubstantiated charges into the record. And there was not a hint of protest from the New York Times media that maybe this is not an ethical thing to do.
It sort of violates fundamental rules of journalism, doesn't it? As a serious practitioner of the craft.
Frank, in my opinion, I mean, that I wrote the next day, I wrote a story about all the charges that they cited in that dossier in public that have not been verified. And if that's all they have, that's all they have.
And just to be clear, Rowan, for our audience's benefit and my own, when you say the New York Times media, you don't simply mean the New York Times Inc. media. You mean the media that is dominated by the now nakedly partisan character of the New York Times.
Some people call it the mainstream media. I call it the New York Times
media.
Right.
I just wanted to get calibrated here. It's unbelievable. I'm not sure I've ever seen anything like it in 40 years in Washington. Let me turn to something else you've been writing about. Much in the news, of course, of late has been the deployment of a U.S. missile defense system known as the THAAD to South Korea. In part, it's in the news because there's a lot of bad stuff going on in North Korea, of course, and the president is anxious to communicate to our friends and allies in the region, to our own forces there, for that matter, that he's trying to take seriously the threat from North Korea. He also, I'm afraid, made a comment to the effect that the South Koreans would pay $1 billion for that missile defense system, which seems to be playing unhelpfully into their election this weekend for a new president. Rowan, talk a little bit about that, if you would, and specifically what the North seems to be doing to try to, defeat that THAAD system.
What I obtained, Frank, was an internal report that went to Congress from the Congressional Research Service, and it was an analysis of Kim Un's strategy in launching all these ballistic missiles, because it's sort of his calling card. It's how he gets his neighbors jittery. It's how he brings importance to his dictatorship in terms of international opinion. And according to the CRS report, especially last year, they were launching their ballistic missiles, their short range and their medium range missiles, as high as they could possibly get them, so it would descend at a much sharper angle and at a much faster speed. And in their calculations, this can defeat our interceptors, our counter missile interceptors that we put THAAD in place earlier this week, and we have Patriot there now. So it discloses that they're really serious about these missiles, that they do plan, if they think it's necessary, to launch missiles at our troops and perhaps at the capital of Seoul. And they're trying to come up with a way to defeat our defense systems, which may work. And, of course, the other way they're doing this is they're trying to perfect the submarine-launched missile, which would be outside of THAAD's radar. It would take a ship anti-missile system to be able to knock it down. So they're obviously trying to keep our anti-missile systems as busy as possible and having to cover as wide a range as possible, which tells me they are planning for war. I mean, if this guy thinks he's in trouble down the road, that his regime is in trouble, he's going to launch these things.
Yeah. And Rowan, two quick points on all of this. One is there are reports that fins have been seen on the warheads of some of these missiles. It's not entirely clear whether they would work or whether they're real and all of that, but conceivably they would add a maneuvering capability to these devices that might make them much more challenging, if not impossible, for THAAD to hit. But also, there's been a report that one of the missile tests this weekend, past weekend, had that very high altitude loft to it and then detonated at the apex, I believe, which suggests that one of the other techniques that the North Koreans have in mind is an electromagnetic pulse attack. So your reporting on this is bang on and very, very much appreciated as well. Let me ask you about one last thing that you've discussed, and that is the travails now of a really extraordinarily impressive man who has been nominated to be the next Secretary of the Army, Mark Green. Talk a little bit about him and what's going on with respect to his confirmation.
That's right. Mark Green is Trump's pick to be the next Army Secretary. He was a lieutenant colonel in the Army. He was an infantryman. Then he went to medical school and was a flight surgeon assigned to special operations. And he was in Iraq twice and Afghanistan twice. He received the Air Medal with a V device for valor. So he's a war hero. And then he got elected to the state Senate in Tennessee, and he started his own medical providers business, which has been quite successful. So he seems like a really good pick to be Army Secretary, right? Well, not to the gay movement, because they say that he has made comments about transgender people that are insensitive. He's likened it to a medical condition, which, of course, the Pentagon did for years.
Well, and I think actually the medical community does as well, even to this day, does it not?
And he also, they said, has made insensitive comments about Islam. So that's kind of the classic attack from the left on a conservative Christian, in my opinion. And so they want, you know, Trump to withdraw the nomination. And so far, I don't see any indication they are. He wrote on Facebook, Mr. Green did, Dr. Green, a vigorous defense that the gay rights movement is cherry picking a comment here and a comment there, totally out of context. But he's always talked about Islamic terrorists as the enemy of the United States, not Islam.
I know you'll keep on it. Come back to us again, Rowan, very soon, if you would. Thanks so much for your time today. Next up, our duty expert on Venezuela, Russ Dallin, joins us straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We are joined at this hour by one of our regulars, the man who takes us for a guided tour inside the ring each week here at Secure Freedom Radio. He is Bill Gertz, the prize-winning columnist with Inside the Ring at the Washington Times and also senior editor of the Washington Free Beacon. His reporting on all of the issues of our time with respect to national security is really incredibly impressive and gives us lots of grist for this mill. Bill, thanks so much for joining. It's great to be with you.
Hi, Frank. Good to be on the program.
Thanks. Listen, I want to talk first and foremost about a story you had in your Inside the Ring column this week about Chinese supercomputers and the fact that they seem now to be poised, if they haven't already accomplished it, to actually surpass the capability of the United States in a field in which we have long been dominant. First of all, give us a quick read on both the state of play at the moment, as you understand it, Bill, and what its implications might be if so.
Yeah, this is a really important story. And basically, it is based on the idea that I was approached about 2 months ago or several months ago by a guy who's working on something called the Supercomputing Initiative. And it was an effort, government effort. And the result of that study was a conference in September. And it produced a report by the National Security Agency and the Department of Energy, which are focused on this issue of supercomputers. And it was fairly dire in its understanding that the Chinese have made important gains, especially in producing supercomputers, and that this has very negative effects for U.S. national security, since it suggested that with the Chinese lead in supercomputing, that the U.S. would be forced to rely on Chinese designs, Chinese technology, and Chinese models for this ultra-high-speed computing capability, which is used primarily from a defense standpoint for designing weapons, things like hypersonic weapons, even less advanced or less advanced weapons such as tanks and aircraft. We need supercomputing capability, and if we lose that to the Chinese, this report was issuing a dire warning that we better take steps now to prevent that from happening.
Yeah, and Bill, this NSA and DOE, National Security Agency and Department of Energy study really suggests that where we're likely to find ourselves seriously disadvantaged is with respect to the nuclear weapons complex, isn't it? The we were discussing earlier in the week with Mark Schneider, our mutual friend, the fact that we've allowed that sort of industrial infrastructure that supports our most critical military systems to essentially atrophy. And this would be one example of that, I would guess. Bill, but talk about it. You've focused on this so clearly for so long. The combined effect of our neglect, malign neglect, and the investment that Chinese have been making, among other things, in buying up Silicon Valley's high technology companies seems to have real national security implications at this point.
Yeah, and especially on the nuclear front. The problem is that anti-nuclear activists in government and Congress have prevented the United States from developing new and more modern and more effective and safer nuclear weapons. And that's one of the reasons that there hasn't been a push for supercomputing capability, because we've been banned from testing. It's a self-imposed moratorium, although there's a treaty out there that's unratified as you know.
Actually rejected by the United States Senate, to put a fine point on it.
Yes. And so we really need supercomputing capability to modernize our nuclear weapons. I'm hoping that the Trump administration will reject the past policies which said we can't build new nuclear weapons and try to refurbish these old weapons that are reaching, you know, the limits of their extension. I mean, they're 30 and 40 years old, and at the same time, you
long
have the
past
Chinese
their design
the
date.
Yeah, and the Chinese and Russians are going ahead with new weapons, new designs, new capabilities, new technology. So this is really undermining our strategic nuclear deterrence capability.
Yeah, some of which we may not even fully understand without the benefit of the best supercomputers in the world. Bill, let me turn to one other subject you talked about recently, and that is the politicization of security clearances in the United States government. It seems as though this has been happening now for a while, both giving people clearances who shouldn't have them and taking away clearances from people who should, or denying them to them. Talk about the peculiar case of a fellow by the name of Adam Lovinger in the National Security Council at the moment.
Yeah, well, I wrote a piece for the Free Beacon that appeared Monday, and the thrust of the story was that the security clearance process has become politicized, especially at the White House. And what's happening is that the intelligence community, because they disagree or dislike those who have been selected by President Trump to take senior positions in the national security bureaucracy, they're using the clearance process to block these people from doing their jobs. And it's a severe problem. The same day that I reported that, on May 1st, Adam Lovinger, who is a 12-year veteran of the Office of Net Assessment at the Pentagon, was notified that his security clearance had been pulled. He had been detailed since January to the National Security Council staff, where he is working to set up a net assessment capability within the White House. What it appears to me is this is a political backlash by anti-Trump elements within the U.S. government, especially the intelligence community, who are going after Trump appointees, especially those related to retired Lieutenant General Michael Flynn, who was forced out after the disclosure, the leak of highly sensitive intercepts disclosed his conversations with the Russian ambassador.
Yeah. It's a very troubling practice, and I've been worried, as you have, I know, Bill, for a long time, that the people who, as I said, should not be passing even the barest of national security clearances, let alone getting access to extremely sensitive, compartmentalized information in some cases. But this is another manifestation, I guess, of the politicization.
I would also point out, that the opposite occurred during the Obama administration, when we learned from the Podesta emails that Ben Rhodes, someone with no national security experience and who was recognized as pretty much of a political hack, was denied an interim top secret clearance by the FBI. And yet, through pressure from the Obama White House, he was eventually granted access to secrets and went on to become the Deputy National Security Advisor for Strategic Communications, a post from which he was able to organize, and I outline this in my book, I War, the false publication of information about the Iran nuclear deal in order to get congressional support for that.
Bill, you've talked about how a terrific organization, the Middle East Media Research Institute, better known as MEMRI, has published a study on the importance of something, it sounds like it was plucked really right out of your book, of countering jihadism online. Tell us a little bit about that importance and why we are not doing enough in that department.
Yeah, this was a report that was made public this week by MEMRI, and basically they made the point that, look, we have got to do more, take aggressive steps to counter online jihadism. And it pointed out that there's a trend now that families of people who were killed by terrorists who are using the internet to recruit and to fundraise are now beginning to sue some of the social media companies. And we're also seeing that social media companies are under increasing pressure to do more to prevent terrorists from using social media, again, for recruitment, actually for command and control in some cases. And much more needs to be done in this field. The U.S. government has been extremely neglect, and I point this out in IWAR, that the U.S. government needs to do much more. It's not simply a matter of having the State Department enter into tweet wars with terrorists. They've got to take serious ideological offensives against these terrorist groups.
And it unfortunately seems to be the case that the principal targets of the efforts of Google and Facebook and the like is shutting down American patriots who are opposing the jihadists, not so much the jihadists. Bill, this is a subject we'll return to with you, I hope, again next week. Thank you so much for your time today and for the terrific work you do at both the Washington Times and the Washington Free Beacon. Keep up the good work, my friend, as always.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We're joined by Russ Dallin, one of our go-to guys on matters involving our hemisphere, most especially Venezuela, a country with which he has had long and very insightful associations. Russ knows about all of these issues because of, among other things, his role as the president and editor-in-chief of the Latin American Herald Tribune. He is also an international banker by training. He's the head of Caracas Capital Markets. I'm very pleased to have him back. Russ, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Secretary Gaffney, for having me. It's always a pleasure and much more importantly, informative.
Thank you. Well, it's informative because of you, my friend. Let me talk to you about the latest developments here concerning Venezuela, and then we'll talk about what's going on there. There has been a report, I think you may have been the folks who broke it, that Corey Lewandowski, a man who was sort of thrust into national attention by virtue of his being the first campaign manager for the Trump candidacy, that he had taken up with this company Citgo, which we've talked about with you and others over the past couple of weeks, that seems to be migrating from Venezuelan control into the hands of the Russians, with some very obvious and ominous implications for our energy and perhaps indeed our national security. Talk about what Corey Lewandowski's up to and what its implications might be.
Well, it all happened very very quickly. In the space of 24 hours, it was unveiled that Mr. Lewandowski had been working as a lobbyist on behalf of Citgo since February, when they had employed him, and he was getting insubstantial $25,000 a month for that contract. But Mr. Lewandowski had failed to register that with the Office of Disclosure, of Federal Disclosure, with the Senate, which maintains a database of all these things. And apparently, he had not registered as a lobbyist. In addition, he
and anybody, as I understand it, it's not just Citgo. Is that right?
That's correct. Yeah, not just Citgo. This new company that he and another Trump campaign strategist had founded in January, had also apparently...
This is Avenue Strategies, I believe.
Avenue Strategies, yes, had partnered with some other companies and was their materials that they were the company in Asia was showing around was guaranteeing access to the president. So at any rate, once the media shed light on that, it acted as a disinfectant and quickly cleaned up that part of the swamp. And the company, Mr. Lewandowski left split with his partner over the issue.
So is it the case, as best you can tell, Russ Dallin, that Avenue Strategies minus Lewandowski is still promoting the idea that Citgo should become a Russian-owned company?
Unfortunately, we have not seen any of the work they've done on the issue, although we follow it closely. We don't know if they were responsible for the $500,000 that was donated by Citgo to the Trump inauguration committee either. All very strange though for a company that you know, representing a country that's in dire economic straits, where the 82% of the population is living in poverty.
Russ, let me turn to another development in Venezuela itself, and that is the continuing drama playing out between the rioting in the streets and the effort of the Maduro regime to hold on to power. Tell us about this idea of a new constituent assembly, what it has as its remit, as they say in diplomatic circles, and what's likely to come of it.
It's a complicated mess, but what it comes down to is the will of Mr. Maduro to remain in power and do everything he can to stay in power, even though 80% of the population wants him to go. And so what he has done now, there is rioting in the streets. The population has been since the beginning of last month, when Mr. Maduro's Supreme Court, who was all handpicked by him, decided to formalize what had been the practice for the past year, and just wrote in an opinion that the National Assembly, the parliament, their Congress, which had been dominated since December of 2015 by the opposition, no longer existed, and that the Supreme Court would be exercising the National Assembly's functions to approve contracts, basically to approve especially the contracts with the Russians for the sale of the oil fields, which the Russians were unsure wanted to do, but wanted some legal security. But the opposition had warned them that without National Assembly approval, when and if the opposition came into power, they would be kicked out and those contracts would be disavowed without their approval. So in trying to get around that, the Supreme Court decided that the National Assembly no longer existed and that it would assume its functions. The population rose up and the international community also rose up against that. But the population has been protesting almost every other day since, with these massive flash protests, and 36 people have been killed as the Venezuelans increasingly use the Cuban tactics of just bashing their heads in.
Russ, let me ask you about one other development here in the United States. The United States Senate has been responding on a remarkable, it seems, bipartisan basis for a change to these developments in Venezuela, with the introduction of the Venezuelan Humanitarian Assistance and Defense of Democratic Governance Act. Tell us about its provenance and its prospects.
It is remarkable, and I think there was some concern that there was kind of a lack of leadership on these issues coming from the State Department and or the White House. And so the Senate and the House of Representatives have been very active on these forefronts, much more close to the population, and have been passing these rules. So in 2014, for example, we also had these protests against Maduro. And at that point, Marco Rubio and so they passed an act in 2014 to help Venezuela, which started the ball rolling and called for sanctions on Venezuelan officials who were involved in these kind of violations of human rights. And 140 Venezuelans are now banned from coming to the United States. They've withdrawn their visas. Those names have not been released, but another seven were recently put on the Office of Foreign Assets Controlled Drug Kingpin list, including seizing their assets and last this
all important
week.
Steps in the right direction. Do you anticipate the Senate will in fact adopt this language and tighten the screws further? And if so, Congress as a whole will approve it?
I do. I do. I think there's bipartisan concern, having spoken with members in both the House and Senate about what is going on in Venezuela, which, as we know and have often repeated here, has the largest oil reserves in the world.
Russ Dahlin, we have to leave it at that for the moment. Thank you so much for your time and for the terrific work you all do at the Latin American Herald Tribune. Come back to us again soon. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Afton. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.